the deadliest airspace in the history of modern air war. That phrase alone, it really paints a picture, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And that's exactly the environment we're diving into today.
We're going deep on a harrowing three-day search and rescue mission. Happened in the infamous Mujia Pass during the Vietnam War.
Yeah, our focus today is really on episode 14, the deadliest airspace in the history of modern air war, Mujia Pass. It's from the YouTube channel Military Tales.
What's great is we're hearing it directly from the pilots, right? The guys who are actually there.
Exactly. First-hand accounts. That's what makes it so intense, hearing them describe what they went through.
You're getting it straight from the source.
Yeah.
So our mission, let's say, for this deep dive, it isn't just to, you know, list events.
No, not at all. We want to understand the sheer scale of the challenges, the incredible heroism involved in trying to save downed airmen.
In what sounds like one of the worst places imaginable. Seriously. Prepare for some stark realities about aerial combat, rescue ops, and just the dedication it took.
It's pretty eye-opening stuff.
Okay, let's start with the place itself. Mujia Pass. We know it was deadly, but why? What made this spot such a nightmare?
Well, strategically, it was absolutely critical. Think of it like a bottleneck on the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Oh.
Episode 14 really stresses how it was one of only three main passes connecting North Vietnam and Laos.
Right, and with the DMZ sort of locked down.
Exactly. The North Vietnamese funneled almost everything, troops, supplies south through routes like Mujia, so naturally it became a huge target.
Which means they defended it heavily.
Extremely heavily. That concentration of traffic meant it was bristling with anti-aircraft guns.
So this vital narrow passage was loaded with defenses. But it wasn't just the enemy shooting at them, was it? The landscape itself sounds lethal.
Oh, absolutely. The descriptions from the pilots in episode 14 are vivid. It's narrow, maybe 2-3 miles across.
That's tight for flying.
Very tight. And steep. About 6 miles long, but you've got elevation changes up to like 2,000 feet. Plus, years of bombing had chewed up the roads, made them look like the moon's surface. What's the real terror? The karst formations.
Limestone cliffs?
Yeah, these incredibly sharp vertical limestone cliffs lining the pass, the river. One pilot basically said, you go down there, you're meeting those razor edges. No question.
Okay, so heavily defended, incredibly tight, sharp rocks everywhere, literally nowhere to hide. Mm. I see why they called it the worst possible place to get shot down.
Precisely.
And that brings us right to the incident. Boxer 2-2 Bravo.
Ugh.
This is what kicked off the whole three-day rescue effort.
That's the one. Boxer 2-2 Bravo was an F-4 Phantom, two-man crew. Got shot down right in the middle of Mujia Pass.
And the response, as we hear in episode 14, was immediate.
Immediate and massive, which, you know, really shows the priority they put on trying to get their people back.
Definitely. So who went in first? What was the initial response team?
The initial team on scene, they were the A-1 Sky Raiders, the legendary Sandys.
Ah, the Sandys, right.
Four of them were on alert. Sandy 1, the lead. Sandy 2, his wingman. Then Sandy 3 and Sandy 4. They got the call and scrambled around 10:00 a.m.
Okay, for anyone less familiar, what exactly was the job of these Sandy aircraft in a rescue like this? They weren't just fighters, right?
No, not at all. Think of them as the on-scene commanders and the protectors. They were basically running the whole show.
Orchestrating everything.
Yeah, like conductors of this incredibly complex, dangerous orchestra. They had dozens of other aircraft jets, choppers they could call on, but their main job, the absolute priority.
Get the guys out.
Well, yeah, but how they did that was key. As one Sandy pilot put it, their job was to make it safe enough for the helicopters to even try to get in. Press the ground fire, coordinate everything.
Okay, so day one begins. The Sandys arrive over Mujia Pass.
Mm.
What do they find? Must have been, well, daunting.
Oh, absolutely daunting. The Sandy lead, he got there and immediately saw just how dense the defenses were.
Yeah.
Episode 14 talks about guns embedded in caves.
Caves, wow, hidden.
Right at the base of those karst cliffs. Really hard to spot. There was one particularly nasty one, a twin barrel 37mm anti-aircraft gun. It actually fired directly at Sandy 2, the wingman.
Jeez. Did they suspect other types, too?
Yeah, they suspected tracked guns, too. Ones they could maybe move around, even elevate at night, making them super hard to pin down and neutralize.
And they're flying in with, as one pilot said, a tremendous amount of ordnance, right?
Yeah.
Bombs, rockets.
A huge amount. But even with all that firepower, suppressing the ground fire was incredibly difficult.
Just too many guns, too well hidden.
Exactly. It really hammers home how fortified that pass was. And think about the guy on the ground. The situation for him was even worse.
How close were the enemy?
Unbelievably close. One account mentions enemy troops were within maybe 15 meters of the front seater. That was Ben Danielson.
Wait, Brian Danielson, the actor's father?
That's the one, yeah. Some listeners might know that connection. Being that close meant the Sandys had to use really precise, really risky tactics.
Like what? Like dropping cluster bombs, doing strafing runs, basically anything to try and keep the enemy's heads down, keep them away from Danielson, just give him a chance.
Man, talk about pressure. Flying low, slow, under fire, trying to protect someone almost within shouting distance of the enemy, and the terrain wasn't helping either.
No, the terrain was a huge problem. The Sandy Lee lead talked about trying to climb over a 700-foot karst ridge.
Just a cliff, basically.
Yeah. And even pushing his A1 Sky Raider, a powerful plane, to its limit. He was carrying so much ordnance, the weight and drag meant he just couldn't get enough altitude. Had to break off.
That shows you the limitations, even with those planes in that kind of tight spot.
Definitely. It was just a brutally restrictive environment.
Did they try to, like, deliberately draw fire to spot the guns?
They did. A dangerous tactic, but sometimes necessary to figure out where the threats actually were.
Yeah.
You know, make them reveal themselves. And then, eventually, the helicopters had to come in. What was the thinking there? How do you get a vulnerable chopper into that?
Well, it was all about risk assessment, basically. The Sandys would try to beat down the fire in one specific area, create a temporary, relatively safer zone.
Relatively being the key word, I imagine.
Oh, absolutely. Then the choppers would make a dash for it. Episode 14 mentions two main approaches, either a quick grab and go if it looked marginally okay, or a more deliberate approach. Really try to suppress everything nearby before the helicopter even started its descent.
And the A1s had that daisy chain pattern to protect them. How did that work?
Yeah, it was this constant aerial ballet, really high stakes. With four A1s, they'd fly in this continuous circle around the helicopter as it came in.
So someone always had eyes on the threats.
And guns pointing the right way. The idea was that at least one Sandy was always in position to lay down fire on any enemy position that popped up. It put the A1s themselves at huge risk, of course.
Shows how far they'd go to protect those choppers. But communication must have been a nightmare.
Oh, total chaos. Imagine trying to coordinate all these different planes, jets, props, helos in the middle of a firefight.
On different radios.
Three different radios. FM, VHF, UHF, all crackling, people shouting. The chance for confusion, miscommunication. It was huge. Another layer of difficulty.
And despite all that effort on day one, the first helo attempts didn't work out.
No. Episode 14 recounts two attempts being waved off just because the ground fire was too intense.
Just couldn't get close.
And then a third helicopter, an H-3, actually did get close but took hits and had to abort. It was just brutal. Mugia was not giving them up easily.
Then they started to suspect something even worse, right? About the enemy tactics.
Yeah, a really chilling thought started to creep in. One of the pilots talks about it. They began wondering if the Vietnamese were maybe holding back some of their fire.
Holding back? Why?
Waiting for the downed pilot to signal. Maybe waiting to draw more aircraft into the kill zone before really unleashing everything. A deliberate trap.
That's a grim possibility.
Yeah.
So end of day one, multiple failed attempts, heavy fire, a potentially waiting enemy. What was the call? How did they plan to change things?
The consensus, as episode 14 lays out, was they needed to hit harder. The recommendation was to bring in the fast movers, the F-4 Phantoms.
More firepower.
A lot more. Specifically using laser-guided bombs to try and take out those known or strongly suspected gun positions very precisely. It was a definite escalation.
Okay, so day two arrives, new strategy. The original Sandy lead wasn't flying lead Sandy anymore, but was still involved.
Right, he flew in a support role on day two, and the focus really shifted towards using support aircraft differently.
How so?
Smoke screens. Trying to use smoke to literally create a curtain between the survivor on the ground and the enemy guns.
Trying to blind the gunners, give the survivor some cover.
Exactly. Create even a temporary window, maybe, for a rescue attempt. Yeah. But even laying smoke like that, low and slow, was incredibly dangerous work.
And then came something really unexpected, the attempt to use gas.
Yeah, that was pretty extraordinary. Riot suppression gas, basically tear gas.
Dropped from a plane.
Dropped from an aircraft flying incredibly low and fast. The pilot in episode 14 describes flying something like 15 feet off the ground.
15 feet at speed.
At over 340 knots, dispensing these canisters of gas. Just unbelievably risky flying.
What was the goal with the gas?
It was a desperate measure, really. Try to temporarily incapacitate any enemy troops right near Danielson. Give a rescue crew a tiny advantage.
And they make it clear this wasn't like nerve gas or anything.
No, no. The episode clarifies that. It was like police tear gas.
Yeah.
Designed to disorient, make breathing difficult, incapacitate temporarily, not kill. Still, the risk involved in delivering it, mind-boggling.
Flying that low, that fast, in that environment. But even with smoke and gas, the problems continued. Another helicopter incident.
Yeah, the bad luck, or maybe just the sheer difficulty of the place, continued. Another pickup attempt, and the helicopter's tail rotor hit a tree.
Ouch. Damaged?
Damaged enough to abort, certainly. Then, on yet another attempt, there were communication issues.
What happened?
The helicopter somehow went too far, overshot the survivor's position, and ended up lingering in the hot zone. It took multiple hits from ground fire, just setback after setback.
So heading into day three, things are still looking incredibly grim.
Absolutely. The intensity just didn't let up.
The original Sandy lead was back flying support again.
Yeah, dropping smoke bombs again, trying to create those visual screens. And we get this really powerful account from one of the A1 pilots who'd been there from the start.
What did he share?
He talked about taking 5 direct hits on a Sky Raider just on the first day.
5 hits. And he made it back.
Made it back. Mostly small arms fire, he thought. But it just shows. These planes were tough. The pilots were incredibly skilled, but they were constantly getting shot at. It was just a matter of how bad the hit was.
And that pilot's experience leads into a broader point they make in episode 14 about just the routine danger these guys face, right?
Yeah.
Even on regular missions.
Exactly. They flew night missions in that same area all the time, hunting trucks on the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Same deadly airspace.
The same deadly airspace.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of anti-aircraft fire they faced routinely, it's staggering.
Like how much?
Episode 14 gives this example. 3 aircraft flying together might draw over 2,200 rounds of AAA fire in just 15 or 20 minutes.
2,200 rounds. That's unbelievable.
Just think about that volume of fire. They describe the different types, too. The fast-firing 37mm, usually in 7-round clips, tracked you. The 23mm quad guns, which felt like someone was just throwing rocks at the plane, just a constant stream.
And the bigger stuff.
And the 57mm. That could reach higher altitudes, and crucially, it often had no tracer around, so you wouldn't see it coming until it exploded near you, or worse, just a terrifying environment to operate in night after night.
So how did they survive that? How do you fly through that kind of flak?
Evasive maneuvers were key. Constant, unpredictable movement. They called it jinking.
Jinking? What did that involve?
It meant never flying straight and level, never making a predictable turn, constantly using the stick and the rudder pedals to abruptly change the aircraft's direction and attitude.
To throw off the gunner's aim.
Exactly. Make it impossible for them to track you accurately and get a firing solution. And rudder control, especially, was critical in the A1 Sky Raider.
Why the A1 specifically?
It was a powerful prop plane, slow compared to jets, and had a lot of engine torque you had to manage. One pilot in the episode even contrasts it with jet training, saying rudder use just wasn't hammered home for jet pilots the way it had to be for survival in the A1 in that low-level, high-threat environment.
Incredible skill, constant focus, nerves of steel just to do the job.
Day in, day out. Or night after night.
And the overall scale of this specific 3-day rescue effort for Boxer 2-2, it really hits home when episode 14 mentions the logistics, right? Running low on ammo.
Yeah, that detail is really telling. By the third day, they had expended so much ordnance bombs, rockets, bullets trying to suppress fire and protect Danielson that they actually had to start arranging for resupply, backfilling munitions all the way from the United States.
For one rescue mission.
For one rescue mission. It just shows the immense resources poured into it. As they say in the episode, Boxer 2-2 became a classic example of the air war effort being concentrated on saving just one downed individual.
And reflecting on it all, the pilots in episode 14 share some pretty deep thoughts, don't they?
Yeah.
About the responsibility the bonds formed.
Absolutely. They talk about the incredible responsibility given to guys who are often quite young, maybe just lieutenants, flying as Sandy pilots, Sandy leads, making life and death decisions.
And the camaraderie.
That comes through so strongly. That bond, the trust between combat aviators. They repeatedly say it's unlike anything you find in civilian life.
There's that quote.
Yeah. Those who shed their blood with me today shall be my brother. It really captures that deep connection forged under fire.
They also mention another mission, Knife 6162.
Right, the Prairie Fire Mission, another huge, costly rescue effort. Apparently, that one involved the most people actually on the ground who were eventually rescued, something like 60 individuals. They bring it up to show that Boxer 2-2, while intense, wasn't necessarily unique. These incredibly dangerous rescues were, sadly, a recurring feature of the war.
It puts it all into a sobering perspective. And their final point about preserving these stories.
It feels really important. As these veterans age, capturing their firsthand accounts, like the ones in episode 14, is crucial.
Why? What do we learn?
We learn not just the technical details, the what happened, but the human side. The raw fear, the courage, the ingenuity they had to find, and those incredibly strong bonds that got them through unimaginable situations. It's powerful stuff.
Okay, so let's just quickly recap our deep dive into episode 14.
Yeah.
We've really seen the extreme danger in Mugia Pass for that downed crew.
Definitely. And the relentless, complex efforts of those sandy teams over three incredibly long days.
The critical role of close air support, just hammering those gun positions, trying to make an opening.
And just the sheer courage and skill of every single pilot involved in that attempt. It's remarkable.
Absolutely. This whole account from episode 14, it leaves you thinking, doesn't it? Maybe consider, you know, the psychological side of it. The toll experiences like that must take on people long after the mission ends.
That's a heavy thought. And also, just reflect on the value system at play. What does it say about the military ethos, about how much they value every single life when they commit such vast resources, risk so many other lives and aircraft, all to try and bring one person home?
It's a profound question. So for you listening, what really stood out from this deep dive into episode 14, what questions does this incredible, harrowing story raise for you about aerial warfare, about rescue, about the bonds formed in combat? Definitely something to think about.